number four. All right, we're going to move on and take on item number four, which is the non-point source grants and highlights in the North Coast section.
Next, back. There's the pointer. All right, can you pull up the presentation, please? It looks like it's muted out. Well, I'll go ahead and start anyway. Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Rebecca Fitzgerald. I'm a senior environmental scientist here on your staff. And I am happy to be here today to give you a little bit of a presentation about our non-point source grant programs. And thank you. I'll start by providing kind of an overview of what our grant programs are. And then by the time you're bored with that, we'll be able to move on to our guests' presentations that have some lovely photographs of actually what a grant does out on the ground, some of the real work that we're able to fund through these programs. So with me today, I'm happy to present Ms. Adrienne Garialdi with the Shasta Valley Resource Conservation District to talk a little bit about our Shasta grants. Mr. William Hart, who's with the Gold Ridge Resource Conservation District to talk about one of our active grants in the Laguna de Santa Rosa watershed. And Ms. Laurel Marcus, who's with California Land Stewardship Institute, who's been kind of spearheading our fish-friendly farming program. So she'll talk about some planning and implementation grants that have gone into that program. And then after we're done with that, I'll come back and talk a little bit about what the future is likely, perhaps, to hold in regards to our grant work. All right, let's get this going. So my overview is mostly going to focus on the grants that we administer most directly here out of the North Coast Regional Water Board office, which are our Clean Water Act Section 319 grants and the new Timber Fund grants, the Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Grant Program. But I would be remiss if I didn't also speak a little bit to where most of the money is coming from right now, which is the new Water Bond Prop 1 funds. So I'll speak to that a little bit as well. But first, let me talk about our 319 grants. So these come out of 319, the section of the Clean Water Act. These are funds that the US EPA allocates to California, and then we administer out to grantees for individual projects. We get about $4 million per year for the entire state of California from the EPA through these grants. And the grants primarily fund the construction and implementation of on-the-ground management measures in alignment with a watershed-based plan to address water quality problems for both surface waters as well as groundwaters that can be associated with a non-point source of pollution. So this can be upgrading roads to fix sediment discharge sites. It can be stream restoration, wetland restoration, and you'll see some examples of those shortly. Right now, a lot of the grants that we have are really limited to physical construction type projects, on-the-ground implementation projects. But in previous years, we've been able to fund planning and assessment projects as well, and we hope to be able to do so into the future. Probably not now until 2018 cycle, but we are working to try to bring that type of grant funding back to the state. I want to mention that another eligibility requirements for projects under 319 is that they happen in watersheds that have watershed-based plans in effect. And there have been some confusion over the years about what that means, so I wanted to take just a little bit of time to go through that. All projects funded through 319 funds must implement management measures that are based on sound watershed-based plans that include nine very specific key elements, and they're up here. In many instances, a total maximum daily load, or a TMDL, provides these nine, or well, several of these nine key elements. So, for example, the TMDL often provides a source analysis, so that identification of the causes. A load allocation is your expected load reductions. A TMDL often on a watershed scale identifies specific milestones along the way. The targets in a TMDL are often translated into criteria for evaluating progress, and then there is often a watershed-based monitoring plan associated with the TMDL. So it is for these reasons that typically we look for projects that are in watersheds that have already had a TMDL complete in order for a 319 project to be funded. However, not all of these nine key elements are always in a TMDL, and there is often a need for a more watershed-specific or even project-specific planning document before projects are eligible for funding. This is so that there can be a more specific description of what management practices or what the actual on-the-ground work is going to be, and then associated with that, how much is that work going to cost, any sort of education and outreach associated, as well as then a specific schedule for implementing those management measures. So usually we have a combination of TMDL as well as more tailored planning documents that we use to collectively get these nine key elements and make sure that a project is eligible for funding. And just I want to say that the reason for this is that we only have $4 million across the state for 319 funds. It's a very competitive process. So making sure that we're funding projects that are well thought out, that are focused on the highest priority areas is very important, and this process helps us to get there. I also want to speak a little bit about our new Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Grant Program. It is a new source of funds for us. It gives approximately $2 million per year across the entire state. And this came out of AB 1492 and the 2015-16 California Budget Act that takes funds from that 1% sales tax on lumber products and rolls it into the Timber Regulation and Forest Restoration Fund, part of which then supports this grant program. So eligible projects, it's grants that pay for projects that implement forest management measures on forested lands in order to improve water quality. So it's actually a quite broad range of projects that could be eligible. Forest management measures include establishing streamside management areas to improve shade, fixing roads and addressing sediment discharge sites on roads, fire revegetation, post-fire response, wetland protection, effectiveness monitoring, education outreach, just to give some examples of what the potential projects could be. And one example of a project that has been funded by this grant is the Elk River 2 sediment remediation pilot projects. So that just came out of the first year of funding for us. So it's already becoming very valuable for us here in the North Coast, this grant funding opportunity. So you'll notice here one of the bullets for eligible projects is that they need to be located on forest lands with at least 10% canopy cover. That's a very small amount of canopy cover, as you can imagine. So most of the region that we have here is eligible to have projects under this grant program, except maybe our urban areas and our more open or vegetated valleys. Another nice piece or nice part about this program is that the nine key element requirement that I just spoke to for 319 grants doesn't apply to these. So projects that are in watersheds without those nine key elements are eligible, as are projects in watersheds that are not impaired or do not have a TMDL yet in place. Sure.
Rebecca, thank you. I was trying to think, I can't remember from that program, but does that fund also cover oak woodlands?
Yes, it does.
So anything, any forest type over 10%?
Any type of canopy cover. It does not have to be a coniferous forest.
So watersheds like the South Fork of the Eel and the Russian River, which are dominated by oak forests, would be eligible for projects under that fund.
That's correct.
That's good to know.
That is good news, isn't it? So I'm going to talk now about both grants together because we are administering and soliciting for these grants collectively. entities that are eligible to apply for both 319 and timber grants is what's listed up here on the slide. Nonprofits, state, local, and federal agencies included, including resource conservation districts, are eligible. Tribes are eligible, and public colleges are eligible to apply. As far as the timeline goes, we develop our requests for proposals, and we'll roll out the 2017 request for proposal in August or September of every year. We have a two-phase solicitation process where we get concept proposals, and then we review those and invite back the best candidates for a full proposal, make our final selection in April or May, and then hopefully get the grant executed in the next several months after that. I also want to say that this has been, as far as grant administration goes, it's been a really good opportunity to partner with our state water board colleagues and our EPA liaisons as we go through this whole grant process. We collectively together develop the grant guidelines, solicit for grants, review the grants, and select the grants. So, and then at that point, though, the administration for these grants comes back internally to this office. And it's certainly not done when it's a grant is awarded. There's a lot of time and effort that goes into administering these grants for both us, for the grantee as well, from executing the agreement to invoices, regular progress reports. We report on load reductions and, of course, making sure that the schedule's met, permits are pulled, and that the work is done as it should be and on time. So I just wanted to mention that once we receive or give out a grant, there's still a lot of work that goes into making these happen, as you can imagine. Like I said, I would be remiss if I did not talk about what is really the big daddy right now of funding opportunities out there. Proposition 1 provided about $7.5 billion available for a variety of water projects, water quality, water use, water conservation projects across the state. A lot of these funds are administered by the State Water Board and not directly by us here in the North Coast region, and then by other state agencies as well, Department of Water Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Wildlife Conservation Board, and such. But having said that, I will say that there is Prop 1 funds that's coming back into the North Coast region. Just one example I wanted to highlight was the North Coast Resource Partnership is getting some Prop 1 funds through the Department of Water Resources to the North Coast Resource Partnership, which has the same geographic area as this region. And they're likely to put out a request for proposals in 2017 for millions of dollars for implementation projects. And I believe you'll be hearing from them actually at the August board meeting to talk about their small disadvantaged community wastewater grant program, which is coming up even sooner. So we are seeing some of those Prop 1 funds funneled back into the North Coast, which is great, even though we're not quite as involved. So my advice for anybody who is interested, perhaps in the audience, for trying to find funding for their program is to really keep an eye on what's going on with the Prop 1 dollars. There are regular funding fairs held about every other month at various locations across the state, and the next one actually happens to be fairly close to us in Reading. So these are free events. Grantees can go and see what grant program may work best for them, get some help when applying. And then I also want to mention that I put together just a really short little list, which is an attachment to your board documents. It's attachment 1. And it's available out on the lobby table. That just highlights some of the, perhaps the most relevant grant and loan programs available from the state and a few from the federal government that might be just a helpful list for those that are looking to fund their project. I'd like to transition now over to what we've been able to do then with these programs in just the last 10 years. We've received from 319 and then the last little bit now with the timber funds, almost $14 million. And then going back again to your board package, I included as attachment 2 a list of the grants for that $13.8 million broken out by watershed. So you can see where we've been able to put the funds and some of the great work that has happened because of these grants. And it's really quite an impressive list. I have been, over this last year, since I've been really intimately working with this program, just impressed with the quality and the quantity of grants that have come out. And the simple fact that we have gotten way more than 1/9, being, you know, we're one of 9 regional water boards, 1/9 of the share of the money that has come out across the state, and this is a statewide program. It's quite a testament to the quality of the applications that we receive and to our TMDL program for identifying where non-point source controls need to happen, and, you know, to all of you guys who really have done some great work. And then I also wanted to mention that that list is just a little outdated because just in the last few weeks, we've gotten the formal approvals for some 2016 grants. So I'm happy to say that actually the number is, what, $15.3 million now. The Timber Fund program granted Mendocino County Resource Conservation District with $800,000 for some road upgrades and several watersheds in the Mendocino County Hydrologic Unit. And then the Shasta RCD got a 319 grant for riparian fencing and planting. And Siskiyou Valley, or Siskiyou RCD, got some another 319 grant for some Scott River stream bank stabilization work. So we're really happy just with this last year's cycle.
Rebecca, may I ask you a question before we move on? Because I assume this is Adrian Garialdi going to take this item on. In grant source funding here, you know, there's a lot of movement towards the legalization of cannabis on a statewide level here. And in fact, there's legislation going towards that. There's a proposition. There's all that. And much of that thrust and work has been done towards taxation. And do you know or have you heard of any of that taxation actually being gone towards the environmental restoration side of the equation, grants or something like that?
I've heard rumors.
It's all rumors.
That's pretty much all I've heard. I don't, Matt, you may have more intimate knowledge.
Well, because I know our good friend, Mr. Bill Massey, of all people, was a champion of that angle of taxing and putting some of that tax towards the environmental and resource effect here.
Yeah, it is my understanding that the new legislation includes that some of the revenue from taxation would go to environmental remediation for sites that have been impacted due to cultivation.
Interesting. Thank you, Matt. Yeah. Sorry to butt in.
Not at all.
You were just right there.
I was right there.
Thanks.
And now I'm going to pass it over to Adrian to talk a little bit about some of our, well, both planning and implementation grants that we've been able to help fund with some really good work on in the Shasta. So, Adrian, there you go.
Well, thank you to Rebecca and the board for inviting me today to tell you about our projects on the Shasta River. I'm Adrian Garialdi. I'm Executive Director of the Shasta Valley Resource Conservation District. So here we are, a nice aerial view of the Shasta Valley, and you can see the river running through it. It's a high desert valley in Siskiyou County. We're part of the Klamath Basin, and it's a smaller watershed, but very important to the agricultural community up in Siskiyou County. So through our grants with the North Coast Water Board and some other grants, we've worked on a number of projects to help meet the conditions of our Shasta River TMDL. The first is impoundment removals. We've done 2 pretty large irrigation diversion dams, the Arusha and the Shasta Water Association. And those were complete fish passage blockages, plus there was issues with water quality in the impoundments. We're now working on 2 partial blockages on the river for the Nobby Rice Dam and also the Montague Grenada Weir, which is a measuring weir for flow on the Shasta. And both of those projects are in development right now and design, and hopefully we'll be moving into implementation shortly. And we also have a partial washout at on Parks Creek at I-5, and we're working on design, and we'll be going into implementation to remediate that. So there's 1 additional partial fish passage on Parks Creek that is also being worked on by the landowner. One of our other projects is fencing and stock water on the Shasta, and I'm happy to say that over 90% of the main stem is now fenced, and we're doing more stock water systems, and that has really helped our riparian areas on the river. As part of our on-farm efficiencies, we've put in a number of pipelines, and we also have increased measuring capacity engaging so that landowners have a better control of their water. And then our riparian planting. We've done quite a bit of planting along the river. One thing we've found is the Shasta Valley does not grow trees very well in certain areas, but we have a riparian working group that has been meeting for a number of years and really studying where the best plantings are so that we can maximize our rate of survival. Wanted to point out one of our great planting partners, Andy Baker, retired from North Coast Water Board staff. And then our tailwater management, and I'm going to go into this a little bit more in detail. So, of course, our goals are to increase the dissolved oxygen and reduce water temperature in the Shasta River. So our tailwater program was one of the first things that we started working on with our first tailwater, our first 319H grant. And with a number of different ways, we did a LIDAR flight and then broke the river into some different reaches. And through working with landowners, we identified tailwater neighborhoods, where the first course of action was working with those landowners in those neighborhoods to increase the level of their irrigation oversight. But we also, through this map, you can see, I'm sorry, I hit Laurel. We categorized the river into some various areas. So you'll see these red areas, and these are our most important areas. They're the south end of the river, the upper part of the watershed. This is where a number of the springs are located. So any tailwater that hits the stream in these areas has the most negative impact. We've done a number of projects in that area, and we're also starting to move down into this middle reach. So the goal, keeping warm water out and cold water in. Unfortunately, in the old days when flood irrigation started, they wanted whatever was not being utilized by a landowner running off their property to head back to the river, so we kept more water in the river for the next person. But we know that we do not want that water hitting the river hot and full of nutrients. This is a photo of the Miamber Tailwater Capture and Reuse Pond. So I'm standing on the road. The road runs right here. So looking one way, here's their tailwater pond. This collects water from a tailwater neighborhood, and you'll see a culvert here with a gauging on it. Actually, that measures the level of the water, and if the landowner happens to not have that on and a lot of water is coming and it's filling up, it actually sends him a message. And if you turn right around on the other side, here's his pump. He can open this, the water flows and a pipe under the road right to the pump intake, and then he can irrigate his field with it, and he won't be taking cold river water. This is another project on the Hidden Valley Ranch, and you can see here's a pre-construction photo. There we go. Okay. And the water was running right down this ditch and directly into the Shasta River. Pre-project, it was 499 acre feet were running off and hitting the river. This ranch is not very far from Dwinnell Dam, so right in the upper part of the river. They have some nice springs there, some nice trees in that area that shade the water, great area for coho to rear. So this was mid-construction, putting in this pipeline, and then post-construction, where the pipeline picks up this water to be able to irrigate the field, and now there was 126 acre feet that actually were running off. And this is just a list of the various tailwater projects implemented from 2008 to 2015. And you can see it's quite a comprehensive list with a lot of efficiency projects and also reuse projects. As far as our riparian protection projects, this is a nice photo from Hidden Valley Ranch, the same one from the tailwater program. And you can see, they have some very nice trees here, but this is very shallow and not very deep because the cattle have been just ranging into this area. So this is 4 years later, and you can see the response here. So one of the things I wanted to point out is that on the Shasta, it's spring fed and the water is very high in nutrients. And what we have found is the first response is that we get all this aquatic vegetation that grows, which actually is the thing that drives coho production in the Shasta because it just produces food nonstop. So a little bit different than most of the coastal streams. And I pulled this out. This is a great picture to show an area that was fenced off. You can see the fence is quite far back. This is what it looked like in 1994. It was one of the first fencing projects that was done. And here is 2011. And it would be nice to go back now and take another photo. But what we found is that we get a herbaceous response in the first season and then some woody response that we see, you know, probably after 15 years. And that's in areas where we can actually grow some trees. So we really want that. We want the bank stabilization. We want this area to act as a filter strip and then also have more shade in the water. So our projects have a lot of benefits. Obviously, many of them help us meet the TMDL goals and also meet coho recovery objectives. So I would say over about the last 10 to 12 years, we've spent a little over $16 million in funding, and of this, we've had about $3 million from Prop 40 and Prop 50 and another $3 million through 319H. And we're just getting ready to probably start about our fourth tailwater project. So one of the great things of working with the landowners and, you know, educating them a little bit more on all of these requirements for coho and the TMDL is it's opened the opportunity to do additional projects to improve water quality. So we have some upcoming 319H grant projects. One is to build a pasture berm to eliminate threats of tailwater return. And then we're also working on trying to connect some of the springs in the upper Shasta to the river and do a water exchange so that they're not using that spring water. We're either reusing tailwater or some other trade-off. One of the really exciting projects that it'll be interesting to see when that's complete is to do a diversion upgrade and also an efficiency improvement and large wood installation at one of the major springs where there's coho rearing. And that will be our first project to do any large wood or other habitat work. And we also have a Bogus Creek 319 grant, and we're going to do some fencing and stockwater systems there. And we have a little bit of additional riparian fencing to do on the Shasta, kind of buttoning up a few odds and ends little pieces that were not fenced prior. So on to the future. So I think one of the really important things to try to get funded is implementation of our stewardship program. We don't seem to have problems funding our in-stream projects and those sorts of things, because that's what all the funders want. But right now we have a number of groups and everybody's out doing work and there's just really no coordination. So having a good framework for adaptive management to help meet water quality goals and also other goals with fisheries and our ranching community and keeping them viable. We're getting ready to wrap up our Shasta River Stewardship Report. We're hoping to have a draft of that out soon. And this will be a living document and will help show the stewardship activities and the accomplishments on the Shasta River. I think it's really important having a coordinated and voluntary community agency and tribal effort to deal with the issues on our rivers. If not, it just seems to build more angst and this uncoordination and people kind of out there just doing random acts of restoration without any way of sharing what they're doing. So I'd like to thank the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program. We're hoping that we can utilize this to house our stewardship report and also information on what we're doing in the watershed. And there's also the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, where we could register projects, and maybe at some date in the future we could actually sell some credits. A very important thing is retention of the historical data and current information for not only reporting to the Water Board on our efforts and our progress toward meeting our TMDL, but just as there's staff changes and over, you know, many years of working on this, you just need a place to have all that information where it's housed and it's available to everybody. And most importantly is having a coordinator to organize the program and arrange informational sharing forums. We no longer have a Klamath Task Force, and there's no more Scott Shasta Recovery Team. So the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program meetings are really the only place in the Klamath watershed where we can get together and have an information exchange. And that's pretty much focused on fisheries, water quality, and doesn't necessarily take in our urban areas and other areas in our district. So I guess that flipped off, sorry. So thank you, and my contact information is here and along with our website, and I just like to say that if you visit our website, there is a lot of information on our projects, and there's also an interactive tailwater map that you can investigate and learn a little bit more about the work that we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Any questions for Adrian? Ms. Mitten.
Thank you, and thank you for that presentation, especially that last slide. I think that's a really important point that, you know, all of these projects to make good things happen on the ground, that planning and coordination is essential, and that's something that's really been lost in the 319H program. So thank you, Rebecca, for the work you spoke to try to bring that back into the program in future years. That's really important. One question, you had a slide that listed a whole breadth of wonderful public benefits of this work. And I'm wondering if you can speak any more to the individual benefits and what would motivate landowners to participate in these types of projects.
I think it's really scary for the landowners up there to make changes. And I think seeing their neighbor make changes, Hidden Valley Ranch is a good one to look at. The landowner was really hesitant about doing the first projects. He and his wife are adamant that they did not want to fence the river. And so we started slowly and started with some tailwater management. And then finally they did a little bit of fencing and they saw the response of the river and the number of coho that were rearing. And he's just continued on and is doing more projects now. And I think as the neighbors see that and that it hasn't impacted his operation, in fact, it's helped it, that's the biggest thing. They always think that it's going to be a negative. So Aruja Dam, I think, is another. There were 6 landowners there. They were very hesitant to give up their gravity diversion and go to pumping. But like they said, now that they're doing it and they don't have ditch maintenance anymore and they don't have to use chemicals to demoss and they have some pipelines and they're able to catch tailwater that comes off another irrigation entity and use that versus pumping, that it's really been a win-win.
Those are wonderful stories, and cheers to more of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Hales.
Thank you. Thanks, Adrian. I'm always a pleasure to hear your updates, and I just really want to commend the RCD for the role that you play in an area that has competing goals and ideals and philosophies with land management, and what your group has been able to do, and I'd like to just also give acknowledgement to Don Meamber in helping pave the way and really kind of showing the neighbors what can be done successfully. And it's just like you just said, you see one neighbor do it and it's actually working and they say, hey, you know, it's really not that big of a deal, and word kind of spreads and that goes a long way. I mean, the word goes a long way over there, and that area, the sensitivities over there to that, the need for it for the river health is just enormous. So just thanks again and just keep on going.
We're trying.
I know. I know you are.
Thank you, Adrian. Thanks. We'll move on to another question. Sorry.
I know.
Are you saying I'm left leaning, man?
Yes. you made a comment that you said if you're able to sell some credits, what does that mean?
If we can come up with a value for the work and the improvement from a project, then potentially it could be sold to somebody who needs can't meet their water quality goal, and then they could buy a credit.
So within your area, you would have some type of credit balancing system type of thing?
Well, you know, we always hope. The problem is we don't necessarily have a city that we can sell credits to. They are doing it in Medford, Oregon, and down here in Sonoma County, but ever hopeful for the future.
So this is Rebecca again. I'll just chime in. There's potential with the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, KTAP, to put into place a nutrient trading and trading program to within the Klamath system, perhaps have the opportunity for there to be buying and selling of credits associated with nitrogen or phosphorus. So it's a potential. That's what we're trying to go forward with. With KTAP, and I'm sure if you want to hear more, we can give you more of an update on that.
Thank you.
Well, and you'll hear much more about it. We're slated for a December action item on the Laguna de Santa Rosa Nutrient Offset Program.
All right. All right. Well, then I'm going to turn this over. You got the little. There you go. I'm going to turn it over to Laurel, talk a little bit about what has also been both planning and implementation grants that she's been involved with Fish Friendly Farming. I hope I don't steal your thunder, Laurel, but I think this is an excellent example of where we've been able to provide some funding help to establish a program which is now enrolling properties into Fish Friendly Farming and getting projects fixed on the ground. So it's just kind of a nice continuum.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting us to speak at this.
Could you please say your name?
Oh, I'm Laurel Marcus. I'm with the California Land Stewardship Institute. Well, this program actually has been around for a long time. It started in 1997. And we were pretty much ahead of everyone else at putting together something that was going to address a lot of different environmental issues. The original idea behind fish-friendly farming, and the reason it has that catchy name, is it was going to be a marketing program, a green marketing program. And when we started meeting with grape growers, they told us, you know, we don't really want that. We want a program that will take all of these environmental regulations that we don't really understand and put them all into one set of BMPs, best management practices, and one farm plan template. So we worked with that group of growers and a number of different agencies, including yours, to come up with that type of a program. So we incorporated the Clean Water Act, Porter Cologne Act, Endangered Species Act for salmon, it's not for all species, state water rights laws, fish and game code, and pesticide regulations. Then we had the whole program peer reviewed. So it has gone through quite a bit of scientific review. So the whole point is to focus on rewarding growers for doing right things and then point out where they need to do some more work and get them to move towards implementing additional BMPs. We have a professional staff and we do one-on-one technical assistance to inventory and assess basically all the features of the property. And it covers the whole property, not just the farmed areas. The certification is done by agencies, including yours. So we have one person from National Marine Fisheries Service, one person from the Regional Water Board, depending on what region we're in, and one representative from the County Agricultural Commissioner. And they go out as a team and review the farm plan and the farm site. The Fish Friendly Farming Program, because we have a big focus on TMDLs, has been recognized in Region 2 in both the Napa River and Sonoma Creek sediment TMDLs and temperature TMDLs as a compliance mechanism for those programs. We also have gotten a number of 319 grants through your board and through Region 2, and every time we do that, we have to do sediment load reduction calculations, which actually are quite complicated to do. Sediment is not an easy thing to measure. And so having done a number of these, we can now say that the application of the BMPs retain about 3 tons of sediment per acre from being washed into creeks. Now the benefits to the landowners are multiple. We will work with them to design, get permits, and get funding for a variety of different types of projects, and I'll show you some of those. Our logo and name are trademarked, so they can do green marketing with it. It's also used by other marketing organizations like the Napa Valley Vintners. They call it Napa Green, but that's actually our certification. We help them all the time. The program has been revised probably 12 times, dealing with new and different environmental issues. And so we are able to add and change things as we need to so that they can continue to be doing the best work they possibly can to provide environmental benefits. We have received 2 grants that specifically came through this regional board. One was in 2007. And about $300,000 of the $750,000 was for the Fish Friendly Farming Program, but in actually 4 counties. So it spilled over into Region 2 as well. The rest of those funds were for various projects. And then just recently, in 2014, we received a $250,000 grant that is specific for the Navarro River watershed and TMDL implementation there for fine sediment and temperature. This is a map of all the places where we work. We work in 9 different counties, so that would be the Navarro and Russian River watersheds up there, and then also Sonoma Creek, Napa River, and Sassoon Creek, as well as a number of the drainages that go into Berryessa on the east side of Napa. And then we work up in the Sierra foothills in a number of counties. So we also work with the Central Valley Regional Board. And we just recently were awarded money to work in the Delta. We were asked by a number of agencies to develop a version of fish-friendly farming for the Delta, so that's going to be a huge challenge. All told, we have about 140,000 acres enrolled in the program, and we keep metrics on everything within each one of the farm plans that we do. So we've assessed and approved 745 miles of dirt roads, 696 miles of blue line creeks, 55 miles of river corridors, and many more miles of ephemeral creeks. Besides vineyards, which are the dominant crop here, we also certify a number of different kinds of fruit and nut orchards, row crops, and we have a whole rangeland program. So we have a fish-friendly ranching program as well. And if you look up on the pictures, the brown is the fish-friendly ranching. That has about 35,000 acres in it. So this is what makes up a fish-friendly farming farm plan. There's these different elements. Not everybody needs all of these. the new vineyard design and major replant design are not often used because we're usually working with lands that have already had their vineyards or their orchards put in. We added the last three, 8, 9, and 10, over the last year in order to have something that addresses workforce and community or the social part of sustainability and then the business part of sustainability. We've been working with the Sonoma Wine Commission so that people in our program could also be 100% sustainable, if you're familiar with that marketing program. So here's just some of the things that are covered in a fish-friendly farming plan. Of course, foremost is to look at soil conservation and erosion control. So we map all of the vineyards, all of the vineyard drainage. We look at all of the vineyard outlets, which is what this shows, to make sure we don't have a source of erosion. We make sure all the winterization techniques are being applied correctly. These are silt fences. This is a straw wattle around a drop inlet, so we don't have sediment going into the drainage system and then into the creek. This one's a little bit harder to understand, but here's the vineyard, and then there's a creek over here. So these grass areas are grass filter strips, and these are actually a very cheap but highly effective way to keep fine sediment that's moving with sheet flow off of the vineyard out of the creek. We also look at a number of different features of chemical use. So this is not just the chemicals that are selected, but how are they applied? How are they stored? This is a storage site right up here. And what does the mix and load site look like? So we're looking at all the different places and pathways that a contaminant could go off of the vineyard and into either a groundwater or surface water source. We do have the county agricultural commissioners particularly involved because this is what they look at real closely. Now, the way that we evaluate different chemicals is not by whether they are organic or conventional, but how big of a toxicity risk do they pose if they do get in the water. So how toxic are they for fish? How toxic are they for birds? What's their persistence, which is called soil half-life? And then what's the likely pathway or movement into water or groundwater? Some chemicals are well known to leach into water and things like that. And then we work with the grower to make sure that they select the least toxic materials and that they apply them correctly. And they have to be monitoring insects, for example, before spraying and using general IPM methods, integrated pest management methods. Now, we also look at water. And of course, that has become the biggest issue in the last, say, 5 years. We not only look at their water conservation practices in terms of both irrigation and frost control, but we look at where their water comes from and whether they have rights to that water. So they cannot get a full certification from us if they don't have final water rights. We can give them a partial certification that covers the water quality concerns, but they have to have finished the water rights process and have a permit for their water supply. Besides looking at, the vineyard portion of the property, we look at all the roads on the property. So this is just an example of one road that we did some work on. Because sediment is the primary pollutant we're worried about, roads are the biggest source of sediment in most drainages. So we do a complete road assessment and a sediment source inventory in each farm plan, and this will include legacy sites. So we also look at old gullies and whether, could these become active again? Are they active, and what should we be doing? So this is a road in Anderson Valley in the Navarro drainage. You can see that it's rilling, and somebody has put the water bars in backwards. It should always go this way. So what we did with this one is we worked with the owner to outslope it, and that's what you see over here, and put in rolling dips. So this is a rolling dip. And they were reluctant at first, but after got it in, now they tell everybody how wonderful this is. The other big thing we work with are the conditions of the creek on the property. So we break creeks into two things, confined channels, which are in canyons or gorges, and we assess all of those different conditions over there. And unconfined channels, which are typically in valleys or wide spots, not maybe such a as big as a valley. And these are the ones that we typically use the term bankful channel for, channel-forming flow. And when we started this program, the National Fisheries Service had just listed steelhead and determined that 300 feet on each side of every stream was critical habitat, which of course sent a lot of people crazy and really couldn't be implemented. So we did a bunch of scientific work pulling together all of the bankful channel measurements that had been done in the Russian, Sonoma Creek, Napa River drainages. And then they did a regional equation so that we could come up with a watershed area to bankful channel width. So what we do is we measure the watershed area, and then we know how big the bankful channel should be on the unconfined streams. And then we're able to multiply that by 4 to get a riparian corridor. So that's the width that we then prescribe to the grower that they have to achieve on their creek. We also do quite an involved evaluation of the riparian corridor, including the extent of invasive non-native plants. Put two of the most common ones there. Well, let's go back one and I'll just finish this. So once the plan is all put together, part of it's done by the grower, part of it's done by us, the three agencies come out to the site, they read the plan, and may add BMPs. They have to be, you know, within the context of the program. And then they shake hands with the grower and tell them that they're certified. So it's a very collaborative, very friendly type of exchange. So it allows, even though these are regulatory agencies, they're coming out there without their regulator hat. They're coming out there with their collaborator hat. And it creates a different relationship between the farmer and the regulator. And I think it spawns a lot of goodwill. And, you know, people like, once they've gone through one certification, they actually really like this program. And so they tell all their neighbors to sign up. Now, these are just some of the projects that then get done based on the plan. We do lots of invasive non-native plant removal. Up here, you can see a rundo, you know, giant reed. And in this case, they cut the biomass and chipped it and then treated it for 3 to 4 years with herbicide before they were able to control it. And then we'll put in native plants. Here's some tree of heaven removal and eucalyptus removal. We also do the understory species, Himalayan blackberry and vinca. Sometimes there's ivy that needs treatment. And in all cases, it gets, you know, revegetated. We'll often work with the crews, the vineyard crews, who will help to put the plants in the ground and they'll irrigate them so it keeps the cost down. And most of the time the farmers are really interested in doing this kind of thing. And this is kind of a major project. This is up in Ukiah Valley. And what we did here is the grower was willing to give up all this land, and then this was graded so that there was a new terrace where they could put a vineyard, but we created a riparian slough or a new floodplain. As you may know, the Russian River is highly entrenched, so it really doesn't have functional floodplains. So we designed this so that water would back up into the slough. This is what it looked like before. It was a big field of harding grass. Then it was graded and planted. And we did a whole bunch of additional work to control yellow star thistle. But now when you go there, it has a pretty complete riparian corridor, big variety of different types of trees, and there's lots of wildlife there. So, you know, that's an example of by doing these collaborative plans and efforts with landowners, it's over 20 acres what this person decided to dedicate to the environment. So we've been able on the Napa River to get well over 50 acres of land dedicated to stream restoration and river restoration. And then the final thing, we were lucky in a grant proposal called AWIP, which is, Agricultural Water Enhancement Program. It was part of the farm bill before the current one. We applied for funds, and this money goes to the NRCS, and we were able to build well over 25 off-stream ponds. This would be in the Russian, Navarro, and the money also applied to Sonoma Creek and Napa River, but not very much of it was used over there. So you're probably aware of the issues with frost water use. So there used to be a process along the Russian River where you get down to freezing and everybody would turn on their sprinklers and direct divert out of the river, which draws the water down and impairs the little tiny fish. So by building all of these ponds, and again, working with people largely in fish-friendly farming, we were able to take something like 90 CFS of diversions off of the frost period, and therefore we don't see these great fluctuations in flow. We also now have a number of sites with gauges. This one's actually in Sonoma County. This is a watershed in Mendocino County. And we work collaboratively with the growers so that they can better understand, you know, what are the effects in the tributaries of different types of water use. Because we, you know, there's a lot of work that has to go into changing water management once you identify a problem. So because we know everyone quite well from doing the farm plans, they trust us and they will work with us on water issues because that's a very sensitive issue. I think that was my last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Laurel, thank you for the information. Question, because you mentioned NRCS, you mentioned some farm bill money here too. So obviously you have other sources of money besides 319H that you're tapping into. Were those off-stream ponds in the Russian? Where did that funding come from?
That's from NRCS.
NRCS,
they pay,
okay,
50% and the grower pays 50%.
So it's like a matching contribution in kind?
Well, it's half of the invoice from the person who built the pond and lined the pond. And the liners are quite expensive. They're,
yeah,
it's kind of the most expensive part of the pond.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Great. Any other questions for? Look into the right.
It's a great program. I think
Thank
it's
you.
Pretty cool. Do you have this type of certification for the marijuana growers?
A lot of people have been asking me that question. Once that activity is legal, we would consider adding it if there was interest by the marijuana growers. Yes. But we can't do it until it's legal because none of our agencies can go and certify people. And I'm not sure that the NMFS federal folks can. We'll have to kind of work with them to see if it's possible.
So you're thinking after 2018 then, when licensing's available? It's when it federally is legal.
Well, I don't know. I mean, for example, the NRCS cannot give, mm-hmm, marijuana growers any advice because they're a federal agency and they can't do that. So we might have to change who the certifiers were so that we could do the marijuana certification.
Okay. And then what type of marketing do you do to educate people that they'll go and buy something that's certified as fish, coming off a fish-friendly farm?
Well, we have a whole procedure by which anybody who, for example, bottles wine, like a winery, can put the logo on their label. It requires that 75% of the grapes that go into the wine are from a certified vineyard. And we issue a separate certificate that they can use with the TTB because all liquor labeling is very regulated. And so we've done that with a number of wineries. Unfortunately, wine doesn't really seem to have much success with that kind of marketing. Not just us, it's also with organic. It just really doesn't impress the consumer. And maybe because it's alcohol. It might be better if it was a fresh product. We have some olive oil makers who are also interested in putting the label on. That might, you know, have a little bit different viewpoint to the consumer. But I think because it's fermented and it's liquor, people don't think much about where did this come from? How is it grown? Quite so much. So they use it for PR more than marketing.
So the farmer themselves use that and market it, but you as an organization don't go out there and have a big campaign, buy fish-friendly farm products?
No.
Okay.
Maybe someday, but we've had trouble finding funding for that. And there's a whole lot of other reasons. It's just very hard on a small scale to push an idea that consumers are really not thinking about when they're in the grocery store.
Yeah, that takes a lot of education for the consumer to then drive new farming techniques because they want those products. Yeah, it takes a lot.
Yeah, we have been working a little bit with Whole Foods, and I'm kind of hopeful that they would be the one that would do that.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Giusti.
Thank you. Laurel, always a pleasure to see you and great presentation. You touched on a couple things that I just wanted to see if you and your organization have given any thought to. But, you know, the one thing the drought taught us all, that there are limits in this world, and water is a limited, scarce commodity at times. And your program is so farm-centric. It's a great program doing lots of wonderful things. But you did mention, you know, looking at watershed scale considerations, you know, 10 really good farms within a watershed could still have a cumulative impact during severe drought situations. So individually, they're doing great things. Collectively, they're having a negative impact on the environment. Have you had any kind of discussions, you know, about a contingency plan or plan B? How do you approach your program participants if we should slip back into a drought? And say, you know, guys, we gotta make more changes. Have you had any kind of discussions like that to look at a global view or a watershed view and still keep people on a true track?
Yes. Two different things on that. Well, maybe three. There's ways to use less water in vineyards, although I have to say vineyards are a very low water crop. It's 0.3 to 0.5 acre feet per acre, which is about the same as a house. So it
depends how many acres you have per,
yes,
per
water. And we have been, in the last 3 months, installing these watermark systems, which are continuous recording soil moisture sensors. And they go at 1 foot down, 2 to 3 feet down, and 4 feet down. And we learned from these growers in El Dorado County, where the irrigation district put these in, that they were able, seeing that deep water, they were able to reduce their irrigations by about 20%. And in looking at EPA documents, they also recommend these systems. So we have 100 of those systems in. So 100 of them go in this year. And then the next 2 years, we work with the growers to help them interpret their data so that they can better understand, oh, wow, when I'm irrigating that much, it's going way past where I need it to go, or, you know, different features so that they can reduce the demand, because that's probably the easiest thing to do, is don't use as much water. Secondly, we're working with the city of Ukiah. We have a number of grants for them to build all the facilities needed to reuse their water for irrigation and frost control. So that would be 4,000 acre feet that currently is put in the river that would now be stored in a set of different ponds and pumped, I think, like 5 miles total. And all the farmers along that pipeline would then get that water, so they would be replacing their fresh water with recycled water, which is another, you know, great big jump in supply. Then thirdly, we have this gauging system project, which is associated with the Mendocino County Frost Program. So we do nested gauges, as I showed on that one picture, so that we can tell for each different diverter in a tributary whether or not, when there's a frost event, whether the flow is dipping at all. And then once we define whether, in fact, they have an effect on the system, we can go back and work with them to find out other ways to store or manage their water. Most of the growers have storage. There's very few direct diverters along any place but the main stem, and the main stem was set up to be direct diverted. So most of the time, the question is, in a dry year, what happens when the fill and spill reservoir stops spilling? Okay, what's that gonna do? And then NMFS is involved in this through their blueprint program for the Russian River. I don't know if you know about that. It's been going on for about 3 years. And so they're doing a lot of hydrologic modeling so that they can help to answer the question of where do we need more storage? Because that's the only way that you're going to make sure all the farms stay, but you're not going to dewater the creeks.
Is it
All right. Let's just move on to the last one, and then we'll come back.
That sounds great. So, Mr. William Hart, talk a little bit about going from the northern part of the region down here more locally into the Laguna. Great example of a current grant that we have in place right now, an implementation grant.
Thank you. So my name is William Hart. I'm a project manager with the Gold Ridge Resource Conservation District, and I'm here today to talk about our Laguna Dairies program. And I'm also representing Sonoma RCD. My partner, Carrie Wester, is in the audience. This is a grant that we received just over 3 years ago. We have less than a year remaining on this grant. It is in partnership, like I said, with Sonoma RCD. We share the Laguna watershed with our partner, Sonoma RCD. And we're very thankful to have this grant. It provides us with resources to dedicate staff time to developing very meaningful relationships with our producers. So we're grateful to have this program. And one partner that I should also mention is the Natural Resources Conservation Service. Our Petaluma field office has provided great staff support, technical resources, as well as funding for implementation projects that have already gone in, and we hope to do more. So the purpose of our grant is to reduce nutrient loading to the Laguna, and this is by funding priority projects, improvement projects that are identified. So we use nutrient management as one of our tools in the development of comprehensive nutrient management plans. We've been able to provide technical assistance and education. We've had a couple of workshops that we've been able to put on, and we've been able to team up with a local certified rangeland manager to provide some technical assistance as well. And then really right now the phase that we're in is implementation of these priority projects that we've been able to identify. So as part of our grant, we have a number of deliverables that kind of set up the framework for how we operate. We have a technical advisory group that includes members of staff from the North Coast region here, the Water Board staff, including our other members are representatives from the dairy industry, and then, like I said, our partners, Sonoma RCD and Gold Ridge. We have had, in the education and outreach component of our grant, we have had one public workshop. We were able to team up with NRCS and also Dr. Cindy Daly from Chico State. As a result of that workshop, we were able to find a sheep dairy operator who's also in the Laguna. So we were able to include that that type of dairy into our scope of work. A number of nutrient management plans have been developed, and that is really a crucial plan to have in place if any of these operators are interested in pursuing funding from the NRCS. And we have been able to, like I said, we have been able to implement some of these projects that we've been able to identify. So when we started the grant, we had 18 dairies within the watershed that we identified sought to partner with. Before this grant, there were 10 that had comprehensive nutrient management plans in place. There were 8 that did not have a plan. And I don't know how familiar you are with what goes into a CNMP, but I'll give you a brief description. So it provides, it's a living document, and it provides general information about the operation. There are a number of maps that are produced to describe the manure management that goes on, any sort of pertinent local environmental information, also information about types of permits that are required for any work that the producer chooses to implement. And then there are a number of evaluations and assessments that look at what's happening in that nutrient management. So looking at a farm-wide nitrogen balance, we look at the production area, the production, the facilities, just looking at how water is, clean water is managed, how manured water is managed. We're looking at the potential for erosion. We're looking at potential for runoff. We evaluate irrigation if the producer is using irrigation. And then we're also looking at the places where manure is applied to the land. We look at, we pull soil samples, so we have a understanding of what's happening in the soil in order to basically create a budget of how much nutrients can be applied at agronomic rates. That's really what we're hoping to achieve, is not the over application of nutrients, but just finding that sweet spot and applying nutrients at the proper rate. So we now have 20 dairies. We were able to pick up that sheep dairy, and then we're also, there's a new facility that is in the watershed. So we've developed 9 new CNMPs. We were able to amend 3 existing CNMPs and get those up to date. And we still have two producers where opportunity exists. The NRCS encourages that these plans be updated every 3 years. So like I said, it is a living document. If there are significant changes to the operation, it really requires that a new plan be developed. So we have been able to implement a number of projects so far, and we're hoping to do more this summer, this construction season. We've been able to install some clean water diversions in the form of new roofing. We teamed up with the NRCS on a silage leachate collection system improvement project. We installed riparian fencing on the main stem of the laguna. And we're currently working on a manure stacking pad. And we're focusing on soil health since we're just coming out of the year of soils. And we've been able to do some irrigation efficiency improvement projects in the form of K-lines. So that right there. And like I mentioned, we do have a number of projects that are in the works. And this is really in partnership with the NRCS once again. We have a producer who's interested in constructing a livestock and feed barn. We have some clean water diversion projects identified, as well as a liquid manure transfer pipeline, some irrigation improvements, continued soil sampling, and also some traveling gun systems, and potentially a manure solid separator system. And in this slide, I put right in the center there that healthy soils continues to be one of our focuses. It's really a low financial cost for huge water quality benefits. So really trying to take that one to heart and really trying to implement that. So our budget, you know, I put this slide in here just to kind of show you how our budget is broken down, but I really want to just highlight our partnership with the NRCS and their contribution to producers in the Laguna. And there's certainly, I don't think I've even captured everything that they've contributed. So there's certainly more coming about, but we really value the NRCS, their staff and their technical resources, and the funds that they're able to contribute to our projects. So just in closing, I want to thank Bernie Reed and Rebecca and other staff that are supporting us on this project. The state funds that we're able to receive through this grant in partnership with those federal funds from the NRCS just make our projects go so much further. So we really appreciate having these funds to be able to, like I said, dedicate staff time to working with our producers and providing technical resources. Water is certainly, you know, an important resource for us. So moving forward, the drought, I think, is very much here to stay. So looking at rainwater capture, looking at that as potential projects, or even as groundwater recharge. The Laguna is they're rich in groundwater, and we'd like to think about projects that'll continue to contribute to the savings of that vital resource. I think that compost on dairies is, I think it's going to be something that we should definitely pursue. With the closure here locally of the Sonoma Compost Project, I think that dairies present an opportunity for waste management and providing a value-added product. I've included that picture of a California tiger salamander. It presents challenges to implementing our projects. The NRCS is developing a local voluntary program that is supposed to ease some of those regulatory requirements. There is a program in Alameda County that they are modeling it after. So I can't really speak too much about that. I probably know enough to be dangerous about it. I guess I'll just leave it right there. And I just including a picture of the watershed of what we're dealing with, includes those communities of Santa Rosa, Windsor, Roanoke Park, Cotati, Sebastopol. So it's a complex watershed in which we're working.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, William. Complex indeed. Right? It's got a lot of pieces and parts to it. Thank you very much. Quick question for you, William. You work at it looks like similar to Laurel, that you have fundings that's besides 319H, you know, that there's different funding sources here. I assume in the 319H part of that the underlying in the Laguna, the underlying premise to get to the nine conditions, which Rebecca started with, was a nutrient conservation or nutrient reduction strategy. I believe it was mid-90s out there, right? And then the underlying TMDL, is that right, that that underpins that requirement?
That's correct. The 1995 Laguna TMDL / waste reduction strategy provides some of those nine key elements for the Laguna right now.
And to follow on that too, Laurel, you had mentioned that you'd worked in the Navarro, and the Navarro is a technical TMDL, I believe, watershed. So technical TMDLs have those elements, is that correct?
That's right. There's still the source analysis and the load allocations and the targets and those pieces that align really well.
I think it's super interesting to talk in aggregate about watersheds and the work in watersheds and underlying opportunities. William, I live on the Laguna. I could almost see my house on that picture. I recognize I'm part of the problem. At the same time, I believe that the Laguna is a great big opportunity, and the ag producers out there, I believe, and some of the landowners out there that truly do stewardship and truly have an interest in that Laguna out there are part of the benefit, part of the opportunity to go forward. In many, many ways, not just water quality, in many ways. At the same time, I look at the Shasta and the opportunities and look at that as the potential opportunity of what can happen. I know it's been super hard, and I recognize that the challenges in working in some watersheds are absolutely there. But I think, Laurel, you're absolutely right. I think that walking into, especially we're talking in big way in some of this, we're talking in a lot of way the ag community. It's not to negate or to ignore some of the other partnerships, ownerships, members, beneficiaries, and contributors to the problem and the opportunity. But at the same time, I look at it as, you know, walking into, especially ag, I come from an ag background, and you can't kind of BS your way in there. You got to earn your way into some of those communities. And, you know, one of the first things I wrote down, I'm a consummate, a challenge note taker here, but the first thing I wrote down was that as I look at it, the grants equals partnership opportunity to me, because it operate. You know, we're good at making rules and regs, but at the same time, the opportunity is to bring some funding to it, to bring the and to show progress, to show and demonstrate and prove yourself through this. The important contributors, whether it be a nonprofit like Fish Friendly Farming, whether it be a government, quasi-government, like what you're doing, William, and Carrie, and I know Valerie, too. Call Valerie here for a minute, because you guys are all on the front line of doing this, and then what you've done in the Shasta is amazing, I think. And Bernadette and some of our other people that run grants, and Rebecca, it's really an amazing opportunity to bring together then and go forward in meaningful ways and to learn and to build trust and to improve, right? I thank you very much for that. I know it's hard. I really do. The one thing, though, and I want to kind of ask about the great big hole, is that's the Laguna system. But we didn't really have much with the Russian River system, because the Russian River system has complexity all of its own, as you guys are all aware. And there is not a sediment TMDL here. So I actually had a project recently where a person was looking for grant funding. And unfortunately, there's not a grant funding opportunity there because there's no underlying TMDL. And maybe the conversation is to talk about other things besides the TMDL. We just went through the process of a TMDL in the Elk River, and they're hard. They're administratively burdensome. They're a very tough journey. And in a lot of ways, we know what the impairment, we know what some of the solutions are before you ever get to the end of the thing. And so from the standpoint, maybe a TMDL is an inefficient mechanism in some of these more complex watersheds to get to it. And it just remains an open question to me. How do we get to the Russian River? The Russian River, to me, needs a comprehensive look, plan, and overall strategy for some of these complexities to at least get them into, to get sort them, prioritize them, and then start to go forward on. That's not to say that's not happening at all, because there's many very good things happening in the Russian system. But it is very, very complex. So I really want to thank you guys for coming. At the same time, ask my board members any questions or comments. No? Well, and I just want to, again, just acknowledge the work that's being done here by our staff as at least part of the puzzle, as everybody out here going forward, and especially the landowners, by the way, that have done tremendous things. Jeff mentioned Don Mambar. I went to Don Mambar's property several years ago, and whenever I go through the valley, I always stop there at the weir and look at that. That tailwater recovery pond's looking pretty sweet. It's pretty amazing. Did you? That's pretty nice. And it's got a whole lot of benefit besides just capturing tailwater, I'm sure. Any closing remarks, Ms. Rebecca?
Yeah, there was a few extra things that I wanted just to say, but I'm going to move through them really quick because I don't want to shortchange what the future may look like too much. We do expect to continue to get these grants, and we do have the opportunity every year to kind of identify what our priorities should be. So up here is what we have as draft priorities for both the 319 and the Timber Fund grants for our next cycle, which is 2017. Very broad opportunities under the timber grants, and then a little bit more narrow for the 319, as you can see. But I just wanted to I solicit any input that you have. Let us know in the future as we start developing our grant priorities. And I would say that of the audience, too. But as I look at the audience, I think it's mostly regional board staff, and they do get some solicitation already in what our priorities should be. And I also did want to take the chance, since I have the floor for just a moment, to just say thank you very much and appreciation for Bernie Reed and Michelle Fortner, who's back there in the back row, too. They're our grant staff, and without them, we would not be able to keep these things running. They help us with our invoices, the multitude of paperwork and little questions that come up to on a daily or weekly basis as we work with our colleagues at State Board and Department of Financial Assistance. And so this wouldn't happen without them also. So thank you both. And then there's just some contact information. And that concludes my presentation.
Question back to you. Do we have a presentation then, Adrian, on the Shasta River report, or what happens with that? I think we have one coming for we have at least an update on some of the good work that's been done in the Garcia. I know that that's agendaed in a future meeting. I know we've heard a lot about the projects that you've had, but the reporting, and I know Mr. Bob Clamp back there has been doing a lot of work on that thing as well and has been a volunteer, but does that can you just make sure that we know if it's not a board presentation that you come back and see us, that you be sure and let us know when that comes?
I will do that.
That'd be fantastic.
It's looking really good. We've been working on the draft, and it's coming together quite nicely.
Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for your work and for coming here today. I appreciate it. All right, I think we're going to do an executive officer report. Is that correct? All right.